So I sent this email to you and asked about transformation, women and men, and do women encounter a relationship with a man as a transformative or potentially transformative event? As apparently, speaking of history, men have accounted this muse, this anima, Beatrice and Dante, Jung and Salome and his soul and Tony. And Ruth told me that she had comments to make about this.
Oh. No, I told you I already had.
Oh. Well.
And if you can't remember, they're probably not worth remembering.
No, I remember perfectly, but I bet they don't. Would anyone like to tell us what Ruth said?
I would like Ruth to tell us what Ruth said.
Well, so you had said, did I think that women experienced men as men experienced women as kind of guides to their soul?
Guides to their soul, yes. That's the question.
And I said, I'm not sure that that's the case, that perhaps women experience men as a way to experience their bodies.
Okay, that's exactly what I remembered you saying. Others? Comments?
Well, it's kind of like what you said earlier about feelings and thoughts. If you're a feeling person, this is uncomfortable. If you're a thinking person, this is uncomfortable. Maybe it's kind of, you know, a way to, you know, expand your understanding of the thinking perspective or the feeling perspective, as it were, you know, between the two.
You know, I'm really thinking about transformative journeys. I mean, throughout history, you have many images of women being the muse or the image of transformation. I mean, the Dante and Beatrice, you know, that's one of the classics. In Goethe's Faust, I mean, you have Faust dealing with several feminine figures. In multiple myths, you find this happening.
But is the problem in part because we have not assigned women the hero's journey?
Uh-huh.
Because we have neglected that whole aspect of existence.
Okay, ladies, are you going to let a guy get away with saying that?
I think that's true, but I need to back up because I wasn't here last time and I couldn't make out what you said about something. You said something about soul, that he had said something to you about soul. Could I hear that better?
Well, a lot of our focus last time was on the role of the female, of the woman, in Jung's experience.
Right.
As he was exploring his soul, and that was part of his journey.
Yeah, in the Red Book, he says, you know, when he speaks of his soul, and I found you again only through the soul of the woman, and
so
he was having her.
The same as he's contacted his, he gets connected to his soul because of his experience with women, and the question was, do women connect with their soul?
Right.
Because of experience with men.
Right.
Okay, when it's my turn, I have a comment about
you.
That.
Have a turn right
I
now.
I would say that's exactly my experience,
uh-huh.
Even if I was not aware of it at the time. That in retrospect, that is some way of connecting to that, which is, I don't have the words right now, that has to do with a deeper, more real place within myself.
Lance, I think you misinterpreted what I said.
No, well, go ahead.
Let me
please,
see.
Let please.
Me make it clear. I said that I think that we have not given women the hero's journey.
Yes.
That is, acknowledged it.
Yes.
Or written about it or put it in that realm.
Yes.
And that it is, that may be where the problem is, why you don't see.
This is kind of funny.
What came to my mind, how my father
figured in my life to transform me was that when I was 13, he gave me a standard bow and arrow and taught me how to shoot an arrow straight down the driveway and get a bullseye. When I was 16, he gave me a Sweet 16 shotgun and taught me how to shoot that shotgun so that I could shoot skeet, for example, and get 22 out of 22. So then Dave says, was your relationship with Lee transformative? And it was, but a lot of our life was spent out hunting.
Uh-huh.
So here is this masculine. I'll have to think about this quite a bit.
No, because you're also a woman who's delightfully feminine and delightful to be around as a feminine person. So you have both sides in you developed.
Yeah, I have felt that.
Yeah.
Back to Tony Wolf's medium. Women play the medium role. They are the male's connection to the soul.
Yeah.
But aren't males also a connection?
Yeah, that's the question I'm asking. Is it turned the other way around?
Yeah.
And I'm not asking this question because I have an answer. I'm asking the question because I want to hear answers. I don't know. I'm a guy.
Well, and the other thing, though, is because there's both a positive and negative masculine and a positive and negative feminine, we get that's where the stuff starts getting confusing because so much of the female coming, I think, from the male perspective comes from that negative feminine.
Yeah, look, that's exactly how I've seen it or understood it. I've seen that. And talking to a lot of different women, I've encountered that they've had pretty difficult and negative relationships with the masculine. Now, that's maybe a general statement. And then here's a statement that, yes, it can be that. Well, yes, it can be that. I suspect it can. I've heard inklings of that experience. But I suspect, once again, it's different. It's a different perspective. And so what I'm trying to get at here is you come to the Red Book. This is a man's story. A man's journey. And there's a whole lot of relationship stuff going on here and perspectives. And he's trying to see things not as a man or a woman, but as human ways. But nonetheless, you will sense in his voice, this is a man's voice. So I really think one of the issues here, as we read the Red Book, as we become more familiar with it, are just those sorts of defining terms, those sorts of defining thoughts about ourselves, about our perspectives. Jung very deeply believed, sensed, knew that the feminine psyche was a power that would be transformative to this world when fully realized, and that it had been suppressed. It had not been allowed, as Stu said here, to be the hero's journey, but that might be the hero's journey awaiting our coming age. So I'm asking these questions to you who are women here, who are dealing with these things. Think about that. Your answers over your lives are going to be really interesting.
I think maybe for a relationship for a woman, for a relationship with a man to be transformative, the man has to have been transformed by a woman first.
Are you affirming polygamy?
Okay,
this is getting dangerous. Well, I mean, because, hey, look at it. You know, it's like Tony was Jung's second wife, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'll stop there.
Just to echo, I would take Stu's position, though, that we haven't had as much material. Because women's voices were not either allowed, they were either dangerous or not allowed until much more recent period in time. So we don't have as much material of artists or writers who are women mm-hmm. who would describe. I think there are some examples, but not nearly as many. And so, I mean, it's been a very transformative century, and he was writing at a time, as I was just mentioning at the break, when, I mean,
things are changing.
Yeah, women weren't allowed the right to vote in Switzerland until after his death.
Sure, you know, and when Jung married Emma Rauschenbach, and she was one of the richest women in Switzerland, but the minute she married Jung,
all of her
personal wealth was Jung's. Which is one of the issues when, like, you know, here he's all of a sudden in this relationship with Tony, and Emma's thinking, well, should I get a divorce? And the point is she can divorce him, but he keeps the money.
Yeah.
You need prenups.
That explains a lot.
Can I just do a very short, maybe devil's advocate?
Please, we need devils.
So I just wonder, you know, like, I see the male predicament, so to speak. It's something that is inherently polar, searching for some kind of a completion or fulfillment. There is a lack or a missing that, you know, striving for that. And I see the feminine as not having that lack. It's the ground into which everything disappears. I don't see that if the female has a priori a need to merge with the opposite in that sense. The female already is its own opposite through the fact that it's the ground.
That's really an interesting thought. At the very end of the Red Book, Jung gives his summary revelations. They're called the Septem Sermones ad Mortuos, the seven sermons to the dead. And he makes some really interesting comments in there about masculine and feminine, about perfection and completion. We'll get there. But, well, these are the sorts of issues that the Red Book exists to help us start to think about and experience. Yes?
Well, another question in this might be, are women closer, do they live closer to their souls? Are they inherently more connected as a result of biology, as a result of their hormones, as a result of their rearing?
I would like to, I think that's a very good question, and one of the things that I think, though, when I hear it is, there's no such thing as women. Everybody's different and has a different time in history, a different society, a different family, and so the experience isn't going to be about women. Everybody's different. I mean, I think I'm so very different from my mother, who was just a harsh, tyrannical, you know, and I'm a sensitive person, so I think to say all men or all this particular culture or whatever, that it's forgetting that everybody's individual, and depending upon their history and a whole lot of other things depends upon how they perceive things.
In fact, we are not men and women, or women, we're humans, okay? And I suspect that to the degree that we really understand that, then many of these divisions do dissolve. But it's coming to that point. And it seemed, I just have to put this out, that for Jung to come to that point, the course involved not only meeting a feminine figure on the inside, but dealing in relationship with the feminine in his life as real women. Whether that is so for women, well, think about it. I don't have the answer.
Yeah, I've got about 20 different thoughts, but I'll just say, it seems to me like sometimes we fall when there's that man or that woman becomes like that archetypal woman. And you're like, wow, now that is a woman. And, you know, I don't know, if the closer somebody might be able to evoke that or approximate that, that can cause a strong reaction.
Yes, it does.
Yeah. And then can I piggyback on that with another? And then one author I like, Julius Evola, who I've mentioned to you, very conservative, but he says, you know, as this two sexes have become more alike, we've lost kind of that tension between the two poles, and he sees that as contributing to a loss of eros and love in our day. Mm-hmm. And he summarizes it saying, women who have forgotten what it is to be women are trying to imitate men who have forgotten what it is to be men.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay. Okay. Part two. Death. During his passage into the depths, during these winter months of imaginative revelation, Jung had several specific visions that seemed to indicate an imminent, cataclysmic destruction, vast and terrible human sacrifice. Only when war descended upon the European world in the August of 1914 did he understand that the visions witnessed had both an inner and an outer meaning. The visions had spoken of the epic, the world, and destiny, not just his inner psychic situation. What he experienced and was still experiencing when the war broke out in August of 1914, what he went on to experience still for several years after, involved not just his own psyche, but also a movement from the depths, a movement from the depths that was confronting the spirit of the times. In the draft of Liber Novus, he confessed, speaking of what happened to him in this period, prior to the outbreak of war, "I saw clearly and saw what was to come as clearly as I could see the stars and the distant mountains on a frosty night." That was his experience. One of the most impressive and specific of these visions came on January the 2nd of 1914. He titled it Death in Liber Novus. It is the fifth of the adventures of his wandering that began on that night after Christmas. And I read. "On the following night, I was wandering to the northern land, along the hills, quietly, and they open up to a dusky, unspeakably remote horizon, where the sky and the sea are fused into infinity. Someone is standing there, on the last dune. He is wearing a black, wrinkled coat. He stands motionless and looks into the distance. I go up to him. He is gaunt, with a deeply serious look in his eyes. I say to him, 'Let me stand beside you for a while, Dark One. I recognized you from afar. There is only one who stands this way, so solitary, at the last corner of the world.' He answered, 'Stranger, you may well stand by me, if it is not too cold for you. As you can see, I am cold, and my heart has never beaten. What do you seek here?' My strange and unexpected path led me here, as I followed the way of the living stream. And thus I found you. I gather this is your place, your rightful place.' Death: 'Yes. Here it leads into the undifferentiable, where nothing is equal or unequal, but all are one with one another. Do you see what approaches there?' I see something like a dark wall of clouds swimming toward us on the tide. Death, look more closely. What do you recognize? I see densely pressed multitudes of men, old men, women, children. Between them I see horses and oxen and smaller animals. A cloud of insects swarms around the multitude. A forest swims near. Innumerable faded flowers, an utterly dead summer. They are gazing beyond and pay us no heed. They are all flowing past in an enormous stream. Dark one, this vision is terrible. You wanted to stay by me, so get hold of yourself. Look. I see. The first rows have reached the point where the surf and the stream flow together violently. And it looks as if a wave of air were confronting the stream of the dead together with the surging sea, whirling them up high, scattering them in black scraps, and dissolving them into murky clouds of mist. Wave after wave approaches, and ever new droves dissolve into the black air. Dark one, tell me, is this the end? Look! The dark sea breaks heavily. A reddish glow spreads out in it. It is like blood, a sea of blood foaming at my feet. The depths of the sea glow. How strange I feel. Am I suspended by my feet? Is it the sea or is it the sky? Blood and fire mixed together in a ball. Red light erupts from its smoky shroud. A new sun escapes from the bloody sea and rolls gleamingly toward the uttermost depths. It disappears under my feet. And this is Jung's commentary on that vision. I looked around me and I saw the solitude expanded into the immeasurable and pierced me with horrible coldness. The sun still glowed in me, but I could feel myself stepping into the great shadow. I follow the stream that makes its way into the depths, slowly and unperturbed, into the depths of what is to come. And thus I went out into the night. It was the second night of January of 1914. An anxious expectation filled me. I went out to embrace the future. The path was wide, and what was to come was awful. It was the enormous dying, a sea of blood. From it, the new sun arose, awful, and a reversal of that which we call day. And he concluded this dark meditation with another image, an image of himself. I perish on a dung heap. While peaceful chickens cackle around me, amazedly and mindlessly laying their eggs, a dog passes, lifts his leg over me, then trots off calmly. I curse the hour of my birth 7 times, and if I do not choose to kill myself on the spot, I prepare to experience the hour of my second birth. The ancients said, "Inter faces et urinis nascimur." Between urine and feces, we are born. For 3 nights, I was assaulted by the horrors of birth. On the 3rd night, jungle-like laughter pealed forth. Then life began to stir again. the next night, after this, three nights on the dung heap with the chickens and the very inconsiderate dog. He felt he was born again. And then the next night comes this rather unusual, amusing, absurd encounter. This is January 5th, 1914. In the draft, in the Red Book, Liber Segund, this section is titled The Remains of Earlier Temples. And I have to tell you, when I first read this section in the Red Book, when I first read it and when I second read it, I didn't get it at all. I had no idea why it was called The Remains of Earlier Temples or what was going on here. In fact, I found this passage, this entire section, really disorienting. So, this is what happens. After this horrendous, hellish vision and three nights on the dung heap, experiencing rebirth, this happens. He's walking along a wide meadow that's spread out before him, and he sees two people walking towards him. One is sort of tall and gaunt, and he's wearing tattered red clothing. The other's a little too plump. He looks at them. My heavens! It's the red one! And Ammonius, walking together down the road! But how they've changed. So he goes up to them. And they aren't necessarily happy to see the guy at all. And so he inquires, what's happened? And the red one looks at him and says, well, you know, this is what happened. You come along. And we start talking about this dance stuff. And something comes to me. This dance. I want to dance. And so I start dancing. I want to experience the higher mysteries of this dance. So I go and I join the abbey. I become a monk. I become the abbot of the abbey. And only I am allowed to dance before God. But then some of the other monks start dancing. And then the whole damn village is dancing. Couldn't stand it. I left that and I went out to the woods and I've been dancing and dancing and dancing in the woods. And then there's poor Ammonius. Poor Ammonius. What happened, Ammonius? Well, Satan, you tempted me. I started thinking, maybe I do need community. So I went down the valley and I found some of the other monks that were solitaries. And we decided we'd form a monastery. So we formed a monastery. And all got together. And then one day I thought, well, I really should go to Alexandria and visit my bishop. But I also thought, it might be sort of fun to see Alexandria. And on the boat, up or down the Nile to Alexandria, well, I just decided I'd keep going. Next thing I knew, I was messing with loose women, drinking too much booze, on a boat to Sicily. Completely degenerate. And there I ran into the red one, who had just escaped from the monastery and was dancing in the woods. And he's scared, and apparently the red one scared enough sense back into him that they sort of adjusted to each other. And so now they're traveling together. So Jung says to them, well, it's good. At least you can be friends. And they look at each other and says, friends? No, friends? I could never be friends with him. Friend with him? No. And the vision ends. Now, when I read this, the first time, I was really disturbed. First of all, I was disturbed because I really liked Ammonius. You know, when I read through the Red Book and I came to this chapter, and Ammonius is there in the desert. I have to confess to you, I love the desert. I have a place in the San Rafael Desert. I've been going for 20 years. It's way the hell at the end of nowhere. And I have to go there at least once or twice every summer and just sit there. Because there's no one within 50 miles. And just sitting there and watching the sunset and then watching the sunrise is, I consider, one of the most sacred events that I can experience, you know, with nature. I just love it. And every time I get down there, I just feel, you know, I've sat there many times thinking what it was like to be a monk in the desert, sort of sensing how that would be, because stuff happens. And so here's Ammonius, he's out in the desert. And then he gives this discourse on the Gospel of John that I've really found moving. You know, it was really deep. And I thought Jung was getting it too. And I, you know, this thing at the end where Jung says maybe you need community, I didn't get that as, I didn't understand what was going on there. So now the guy that I really liked shows up a degenerate. And you know, the red one, I sort of liked him too. I mean, this joy thing, brother, brother, joy, Jung reaches out a hand, and now he's sort of a degenerate. What's happened? The subtitle, or the title that he gave in his draft, maybe gives a little bit of orientation to what's happened here. He calls this the remains of earlier temples, but in the draft he called it degenerate ideas. Degenerate ideas. You see, what was Ammonius' problem? All spirit, solitary, isolated, contemplation upon the Word of God. Whew. I like that. Well, that was sort of appealing. Wow, that's worthy of honor. And then the devil. Oh, life. Don't let your hair go gray about that. Just dance through life. Joy. Well, I liked him too. I had red hair when I was a kid. I know what that's like. But just that. Extremes. And he had idealized these extremes. He had put them in as ideas, as opposites. And he was now moving a bit beyond this sort of division of life into devil and saint. Okay? And he gives this concluding commentary. But I was no longer the man I had been, for a strange being grew through me. I was no longer the man I had been. And look, we're only talking about a week ago here, right? That's what is happening in this volcanic eruption. Although, of course, the commentary, the integration, consideration, that's going on here for a year. But I was no longer the man I had been, for a strange being grew through me. This was a laughing being of the forest, a green diamond, a forest goblin, the prankster who lived alone in the forest and was itself a greening tree being. Neither good nor bad, merely living, primordially old and yet completely young, naked and yet naturally clothed, not man but nature. Frightened, laughable, powerful, childish, weak, deceiving, and deceived, utterly inconstant and superficial, and yet reaching deep down, down to the kernel of the world. I had absorbed the life of both of my friends. A green tree grew from the ruins of the temple. Because both of them believed in themselves and their own goodness, each in his own way, they ultimately became mired in the natural and conclusive burial ground of all outlived ideals. The most beautiful and the best, like the ugliest and the worst, end up someday in the most laughable place in the world, surrounded by fancy dress and led by fools, and go horror-struck to the pit of filth. He who believes he is really living his ideals, or believes he can live them, suffers from delusions of grandeur and behaves like a lunatic in that he stages himself as an ideal. But the hero is fallen. Ideals are mortal. And so one should prepare oneself for their end. At the same time, it probably costs you your neck. probably costs you your neck. When I turned green, they stood there, the sad remains of earlier temples and rose gardens, and I recognized with a shudder their inner affinity. It seemed to me that they had established an indecent alliance. And this is what happens to us in life. I've seen this many times. I've lived this, some of this. We get so caught up in our ammonious nature, right? Our ethical, spiritual, whatever nature. And it absolutely cuts us off from life. You find this in religious communities, when people really accept this sort of ethical life, and especially if they tend to be sort of ammonious types, thinking types, they get so caught up in it that it just cuts off this huge piece of life. People live by shoulds and shouldn'ts. And shit, there are so many shouldn'ts.
Are you saying people are shitting on themselves?
They're shitting on themselves, yes. A lot of shitting on yourself. And then one day, what happens to a lot of these folks? Wham! It just fractures. And what happens then? People sometimes swing. Next thing you know, they're in a den of iniquity smoking God knows what with what sort of company, right? The fracture happens. And all of a sudden, you know, like they're off with the red one. Down the river to Alexandria and, you know, off to Sicily and the brothels of Sicily, if there are any. I suppose there are. So, and okay, then you've got the red one, right? The degenerate. Person's like, ooh, just into the pleasure of life. And then one day something cracks. Maybe there's more. Maybe there's a deeper pleasure. Next thing you know, where's he? He's out in the desert in some damn monastery reading the Book of God. It goes both ways. We do go through that shift. What Jung is suggesting here is both of these are actually temples of lost ideals, heroic behaviors. We need something sort of in the middle. And here he finds Ammonius and the red one together. It's like, oh, that's hopeful. Oh, you're friends. Friends? Us? Are you kidding? We're eternal enemies. Although, of course, the red one says, you know, it is good to know something about the church because, hey, if you're the devil, I mean, you know, they are your clients. And, okay. So Jung feels at this point that he needs to find the newborn light. He needs to journey to the east. And notice in what follows here, he's really addressing you. He's addressing the reader. He's speaking to a you. This book is not written just as a aesthetic pretension. He is addressing an audience. He didn't know when that audience would come, but now you're here. And so he says, "Henceforth I am completely alone. I no longer hear requests and no longer make requests of you. I no longer fight and reconcile myself with you, but place silence between you and me. Together with the west wind which comes from the plains of the ocean, I journey across the green countryside. I roam through the forests and bend the young grass. I talk with trees and the forest wildlife, and the stones show me the way. On this way no one walks behind me, and I cross no one's path. I am alone. But I fill my solitariness with life. And so I wander to the far east. Not that I know anything about what my distant goal might be. I see blue horizons before me. They suffice as a goal. I hurry toward the east and my rising. I will rise." On the third night, he continues, A desolate mountain range blocks my way. And when I say third night, this actually was a third night. When you look at his journals, when he says in the Red Book on the third night, it was the third night. He had these three other nights in which he was in this image, this vision of walking through the greenery, speaking with the stones of the forest animals. So on the third night, a desolate mountain range blocks my way. Through a narrow valley gorge, I am able to enter. The way leads inevitably between two high rock faces. My feet are bare and injure themselves on the jagged rocks. Here the path becomes slippery. One half of the way is white, and the other is black. I step on the black side and recoil, horrified. It is hot iron. I step on the white, it is ice. So it must be. I dart across onward, and finally the valley widens into a mighty rocky basin. A narrow path winds up along the vertical rocks to the mountain ridge at the top. As I approach the top, a mighty booming resounds from the other side of the mountain, like ore being pounded. The sound gradually swells and echoes thunderously in the mountains. As I reach the pass, I see an enormous man approach from the other side. Two bull horns rise from his head, and a rattling suit of armor covers his chest. His black beard is ruffled and decked with exquisite stones. The giant is carrying a sparkling double axe in his hand, like those used to strike bulls. Before I can recover from my amazed fright, the giant is standing before me. I call out to him, "O Izdubar, most powerful, spare my life. Forgive me for lying like a worm in your path." Okay, Izdubar, this name is a name for Gilgamesh. It was a name used for Gilgamesh in the Sumerian legend, one of the most ancient of myths. Izdubar replies, "I do not want your life. Where do you come from?" Jung, "I come from the west, Izdubar." "You come from the west? Do you know the western lands? Is this the right way to the west?" Jung, "I come from a western land whose coast washes against the great western sea." Izdubar, "Does the sun sink in that sea? Or does it touch the solid land in its descent?" Jung, "The sun sinks far beyond the sea." Izdubar, "Beyond the sea? Beyond the sea? What lies there?" Jung, "Well, there's nothing but empty space there. As you know, the earth is round. And moreover, it turns around the sun." Izdubar, "Damned one, where do you get such knowledge? So there is no immortal land where the sun goes down to be reborn? Are you speaking the truth?" His eyes flicker with fury and fear. He steps a thunderous pace closer. I tremble. Jung, "Most powerful one, insofar as you are mortal, you can never reach the sun." I see him overcome with suffocating fear. Izdubar, "I am mortal, and I shall never reach the sun and never reach immortality." He smashes his axe with a powerful clang on the rock. Izdubar, "Begone, miserable weapon. You are no use. Should you be of use against infinity, against the eternal void, against the unreplenishable? There is no one left for you to conquer. Smash yourself for what it's worth." In the west, at this point, the sun sinks into the lap of glowing clouds in bright crimson. "So go away, thrice damned god, and wrap yourself in your immortality." He snatches the pieces of his axe from the ground and hurls it towards the sun. "Here, you have your sacrifice, your last sacrifice." He collapses and sobs like a child. I stand shaking and hardly dare stir. Miserable worm, where did you get this poison? Izdubar says to Jung. Oh, Izdubar, most powerful one, what you call poison is science. In our country, we are nurtured on it from youth. And that may be one reason why we haven't properly flourished and remain so dwarfish. When I see you, however, it seems to me as if we are all somewhat poisoned. And then the conversation goes on. Izdubar has been poisoned, sickened unto death, by Jung's modernity. And what is Jung's modernity, modern attitude stolen from him? His belief in the gods, in the god of the sun, in the Western land. Jung is this serpent that has bitten him. And now he lays there, dying. Izdubar says to Jung, have you no gods anymore? Jung replies, no, words are all we have. Izdubar, but are these words powerful? Jung, so they claim, but no one notices this much. Science has taken from us the capacity of belief. Izdubar, what? You've lost that too? Then how do you live? Jung, we live thus, with one foot in the cold and one foot in the hot, and for the rest, come what may. Izdubar, can you bear it? Jung, not particularly well. I personally don't find myself at ease with it. For that reason, I've set out to the east, to the land of the rising sun, to seek the light that we lack. Where then does the sun rise? Jung asks Izdubar. Well, consider this. Jung is... So he's gone through this death and rebirth. He's old ideals have died. He's decided he's going to venture to the east. He's on his way. And while he's going to the east to find the light, what does he find? An ancient mythic god of the east searching for the west. Jung's trying to find the place where the sun rises. Izdubar is trying to find the place where the sun sets. And they run into each other. And Izdubar has been stricken. I'll skip a few sections here for brevity. And this is a very long section in the Red Book in Liber Novus, and it's really important. It's a transformative moment in Jung's story. So Jung is sat there now. Izdubar, the giant from the east, is sickened. He's laying there near death. Jung builds a fire, gets out a match, lights the fire. Izdubar says, my God, where'd you get that? A match. You know, so, oh, yeah, we have that. That's our science. He says, Mike, you know. So he builds a fire. And he sits there pacing all night long, wondering how he's going to help Izdubar, how he's going to save him. He feels that he has to save him. But he knows that Izdubar is so big, he's a giant. How is he going to get him anywhere to help him? So he sat there during the night, and he says, no dream gave me the saving word. Izdubar lay silent and stiff all night until daybreak. I paced the mountain ridge, pondering and looking back to my western lands, where there is so much knowledge and so much possibility of help. But in the morning, Jung sees a solution to the problem. And he goes up to Izdubar. who's laying there sick unto death. Jung says, "My prince, my powerful one, listen. A thought came to me that might save us. I think that you are not all real, but only a fantasy." Izdubar, "I am terrified by this thought. It's murderous. Do you even mean to declare me unreal? Now that you have lamed me so pitifully?" Jung, "Perhaps I've not made myself clear enough, and have spoken too much in the language of Western lands. I do not mean to say that you are not real at all, of course, but only as real as a fantasy. I do not mean to say that you are not real at all, of course, but only as real as a fantasy. If you could accept this, much would be gained." Izdubar, "What would be gained by this, you tormenting devil?" Jung, "Pitiful one, I will not torment you. The hand of the doctor does not seek to torment, even if it causes grief. Can you really not accept that you are a fantasy?" And now Jung says, "The inner voice spoke to me as follows. While admitting he is a fantasy now, the situation remains extremely complex. A fantasy cannot be simply negated and treated with resignation either. It calls for action. Anyway, he is a fantasy, and thus considerably more volatile. I think I can see a way forward. I can take him on my back now." So he went to Izdubar and said to him, "A way has been found. You have become light, lighter than a feather. Now I can carry you." I put my arms around him and lift him up off the ground. He's lighter than air. And I struggle to keep my feet on the ground since my load lifts me up into the air. Izdubar, "That was a master stroke. Where are you carrying me?" Jung, "I'm going to carry you down into the Western land. My comrades will happily accommodate such a large fantasy. Once we have crossed the mountains and have reached the houses of hospitable men, I can calmly go about finding a means to restore you completely again." And so they begin their return journey, Jung carrying a huge but weightless fantasy. There are 32 pages of the Red Book, artistically and textually one of the most beautiful sections of this entire book, dedicated to this story of Izdubar. You have to remember that the pictures were added to the calligraphic rendition of the Liber Novus over years after this manuscript was written. So he finished the manuscript in 1915, and then he worked on the book very seriously and continuously for about 5 years, and then a little bit more sporadically for 8 more. So he really worked on this book for a very long time. This is one of his pictures of Izdubar. There's another one here of him. Let's see if I can find it quickly. Here. This is Jung carrying the large fantasy of Izdubar. You'll find this on page 45 of the folio. So Jung goes on. "Izdubar and I came to a quiet, dark garden and a secluded house. I hide Izdubar under the drooping branches of a tree and go up to the door of the house and knock. I ponder the door. It's much too small. I'll never be able to get Izdubar, this huge fantasy, through the door." Then he thinks, "Yet a fantasy takes up no space. Why did this excellent thought not occur to me earlier? I return to the garden and with no difficulty squeeze Izdubar into the size of an egg and put him in my pocket. Then I walk into the welcoming house where Izdubar should find healing. Absurd? Absurd? Nonsense? Fantasy? I'm reading a lot here, but this is important. This is really a central transformation in Jung's encounter with the fantasy. And at this point in the Red Book, you have really moved way beyond, at this point, the personal devils. This stuff I could relate to his life acts earlier on. This is getting to a much deeper level. I told you at the beginning, you know, Jung was dealing with God. Well, it's a bit absurd, but here it is. So I let me just read on from the commentary. Thus my God found salvation. He was saved precisely by what one would actually consider fatal. Namely, by declaring him a figment of the imagination. My God was saved by declaring him a figment of the imagination. How often has it been assumed that gods have been brought to their end in this way? This was obviously a serious mistake, since this was precisely what saved the God. He did not pass away, but became a living fantasy, whose workings I could feel on my own body. My inherent heaviness faded, and the hot and cold way of pain no longer burned and froze my feet. The weight no longer kept me pressed to the ground, but instead the wind carried me, lightly like a feather, while I carried the giant. I loved my God, and I took him to the house of men, since I was convinced that he also really lived. He also really lived as a fantasy, and should therefore not be left behind, wounded and sick. And hence, I experienced the miracle of my body losing its heaviness when I burdened myself with the God. We should not bear Christ. He is unbearable. But we should be Christ's. For then our yoke is sweet and our burden is easy. This tangible and apparent world is one reality. Fantasy is the other reality. This is a turning point of the entire Red Book. This tangible and apparent world is one reality, but fantasy is the other reality. So long as we leave the God outside us, apparent and tangible, he is unbearable and hopeless. But if we turn the God into a fantasy, he is in us and is easy to bear. The God outside us increases the weight of everything heavy, while the God within us lightens everything heavy. Take your God with you. Bear him down to your dark land where people live who rub their eyes each morning and yet always see only the same thing and never anything else. Bring your God down to the haze, pregnant with poison, but not like those blinded ones who try to illuminate the darkness with lanterns which it does not comprehend. Instead, secretly carry your God to an hospitable roof. Embrace him again lovingly until he has taken on the form of his first beginning. Let no human eye see the much loved, terrible, splendid one in the state of his illness and lack of power. Consider that your fellow men are animals without knowing it. Consider your fellow men are animals without knowing it. So long as they go to pasture or lie in the sun or suckle their young or mate with each other, they are beautiful and harmless creatures of dark Mother Earth. But if the God appears, they begin to rave, since the nearness of God makes people rave. They tremble with fear and fury and suddenly attack one another in fratricidal struggles, since one senses the approaching God in the other. So conceal the God, that you have taken with you. Your voice is too weak for those raging to be able to hear. Thus, do not speak, and do not show the God, but sit in a solitary place and sing incantations in the ancient manner. Set the egg before you, the God in his beginning, and behold it, and incubate it with the magical warmth of your gaze. Fantasy and imagination. Jung employed this word, fantasy. Fantasy. What's he saying there? He's turning Izdubar into a fantasy. Well, Izdubar is a fantasy. He's accepting that he's a fantasy. But, oh, fantasies are real. When he says to Izdubar, I want you to be a fantasy, he says, but I have to explain. I want you to be a fantasy, but you have to understand that fantasies are real. I think that you are real, of course, but only real as a fantasy. Do people get burned at the stake for comments like that? I assure you, if you have, over the course of history, this is some sort of heresy. What? God is not up there? Up there in heaven? Up there in some metaphysical, physical... There. He's in you. In here. What? In here? In this unworthy, despicable, sinful vessel of flesh? There's something divine in that? An experience of the divine in that worthless, dunghill residing corpus we call humanity? Oh my heavens. And it's imaginal. We can experience it as real, but it's a fantasy. Aren't fantasies lies? Lies? They aren't real. But you're saying a fantasy's real? This is the stuff Jung is dealing with here. You know, he goes on, he talks about this word fantasy, and there are three words that he uses when he's trying to describe his experience. And once again, look, this is not a concept. This is not a philosophy. This is not a theory. It's his experience. He met a reality in the imaginal, real. And he used three words to try to describe what he was encountering. Words translated, I translate them here to English. Fantasy was one. Imagination is another. Vision, a third. Sometimes he spoke of active imagination. Imagination, fantasy, vision. He understood that all of these words had been emptied of their content by lack of experience. Right? And so he says, speaking in the 1930s, when he's talking about just this material, about fantasy, he says, I prefer the term imagination to fantasy. Fantasy is merely nonsense, a phantasm, a fleeting impression. But imagination is active, purposeful. A fantasy is more or less your own invention and remains on the surface of personal things and conscious expectations. But active imagination, as the term denotes, means that the images have a life of their own and that the symbolic events develop according to their own logic. That is, of course, if your conscious reason does not interfere. But the term fantasy, the word itself, in its etymology, in its history, does actually have different meanings. And in Greek, the word actually had three senses that developed into our modern languages, all European languages. The senses were an appearance, a spectral apparition. That was one of the ancient meanings of this word in Greek. Two, the process or faculty of sensuous perception. Seeing, okay? And three, the faculty of imagination. These meanings were once all in this word. Where did they go? Well, who has visions? How could you know what a vision is if you haven't had one? A vision is a fantasy. It's a pathology. It's unreal. Jung describes his activity. And these particular comments, I think, were written around 1920. He's trying to describe what he's doing. He says, a fantasy of intensely visual character. This is what he has. A fantasy of intensely visual character. Something which in the language of the ancients would be called a vision. The language of the ancients would be called a vision. Because in modern language, hey, what's a vision? Doesn't exist, right? Not a vision seen in a dream. That's not what he's talking about when he uses this word. Not a vision seen in a dream, but a vision perceived by intense concentration on the background of consciousness. Intense concentration on the background of consciousness. A technique that is perfected only after long practice. Are you getting this? Jung is doing something here. He's experiencing this stuff. Is this strange? Yes. Is it done very often? No. Do many people go where he went? Best I can tell, no. Have some people? Yes, they have. History leaves its record. And Jung spent a lifetime looking for the records, looking for evidence that he was not alone in this experience. In Memories, Dreams, Reflections, he said, "It is, of course, ironical that I, a psychiatrist, should almost at every step of my experience have run into the same psychic material that is the stuff of psychosis and found in the insane. This is the fund of unconscious images which fatally confuse the mental patient. But it is also the matrix of mythopoetic imagination which has vanished from our rational age. Though such imagination is present everywhere, it is both tabooed and dreaded, so that it even appears to be a risky experience or a questionable adventure to entrust oneself to the uncertain path that leads into the depths of the unconscious." It has existed from the beginning of philosophical alchemy and Gnosticism down to Nietzsche's Zarathustra. Unpopular, ambiguous, and dangerous, it is a voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world. What he underwent, he experienced as entirely real. The imaginary, the image and event, was granted full autonomy and reality by Jung. How such a thing could be, he struggled 40 years of his remaining life to explain. And near the end of his life, he several times suffered deep depression that he would ever be understood. He sensed that he had failed to explain, or to have his explanations at all comprehended. It seemed to him at such dark moments that no one had really, truly understood. Jung proclaimed in the initial pages of Liber Novus, "The supreme meaning is the path, the way and the bridge to what is to come. That is the God yet to come. It is not the coming God himself, but his image, which appears in the supreme meaning. God is an image, and those who worship him must worship him in the images of the supreme meaning. Okay, now Jung had this egg sitting there in the house. He had a responsibility. He had taken a God who was real, allowed him to be a fantasy, and squished him into an egg. Now what the hell was he going to do? Jung understood he had God in an egg in his pocket. He had to incubate the egg. One of the most beautiful sections of Liber Novus are the incantations, Jung's prayers before the egg, awaiting the moment of its eruption, of the rebirth of the God from the egg. In conclusion, I would like to read you those incantations. We are still in the octave of Epiphany, for any of you who know what such a thing would mean. This is the season of the end of Christmas. Epiphany is the moment, 12 days after Christmas, the 6th of January, signifying the rebirth of the light. I think it's appropriate. Jung had these visions during this period, and we're there. So, a reading for the octave of Epiphany. Jung's incantations to the birth of a God. Christmas has come. The God is in the egg. I have prepared a rug for my God, an expensive red rug from the land of mourning. He shall be surrounded by the shimmering of magnificence of his eastern land. I am the mother, the simple maiden, who gave birth and did not know how. I am the careful father who protected the maiden. I am the shepherd who received the message as he guarded his herd at night on the dark fields. I am the holy animal that stood astonished and cannot grasp the becoming of the God. I am the wise man who came from the east, suspecting the miracle from afar. I am the egg that surrounds and nurtures the seed of God in me. The solemn hours lengthen, and my humanity is wretched and suffers torment, since I am a giver of birth. Whence do you delight me, my God? He is the eternal emptiness and the eternal fullness. Nothing resembles him, and he resembles everything. Eternal darkness and eternal brightness, eternal below and eternal above, double nature in one, simple in the man, manifold, meaning in absurdity, freedom in bondage, subjugated when victorious, old in youth, yes in no. Amen. You are the Lord of the beginning. Amen. You are the star of the east. Amen. You are the flower that blooms over everything. Amen. You are the deer that breaks out of the forest. Amen. You are the song that sounds over the water. Amen. You are the beginning and the end. One word that was never spoken, one light that was never lit up, an unparalleled confusion, and a road without end. I forgive myself these words, as you also forgive me for wanting your blazing light. Rise up, you gracious fire of old night. I kiss the threshold of your beginning. My hand prepares the rug and spreads abundant red flowers before you. Rise up, my friend, you who lay sick. Break through the shell. We have prepared a meal for you. Gifts have been prepared for you. Dancers await you. We have built a house for you. Your servants stand ready. We drove herds together for you on green fields. We filled your cup with red wine. We set out fragrant fruit on golden dishes. We knock at your prison and lay our ears against it. The hours lengthen. Tarry no longer. We are wretched without you, and our song is worn out. Come to us, we who are willing from our own will. Come to us, we who understand you from our own spirit. Come to us, we who will warm you at our own fire. Come to us, we who will heal you with our own art. Come to us, we who will produce you out of our own body. Come, child, to father and mother. We ask earth, we ask heaven. We ask the sea, we ask the wind, we ask the fire. We look for you with all the peoples. We look for you with all the kings. We look for you with all the wise. We look for you in our own heads and hearts. And we found you in the egg. Here end the readings of C.G. Jung. So thank you very much.